So yes, as Ileana said, I'm going to talk about kind of a slightly different type of rigidity theory than we've been focusing on so far. So I'm going to talk about something called body and CAD rigidity theory. This is based on my dissertation work with under Ileana. It's joint work with Kirk Haller, Mira Sitharam, Neil White, and then the second part is joint work with Jessica Sidman. Okay, so the motivation for this new model of rigidity is coming from CAD, computer-aided design. So I was looking at SolidWorks, which is a popular computer-aided design program for mechanical engineers. And in SolidWorks, I focused on the 3D assembly environment. And in that environment, you have atomic elements. I'd like to think of them as atomic elements, kind of your building pieces, which are called sets, but we can just think of them as rigid bodies. Okay, and you can put constraints between these, which are usually called mates or dimensions in the SolidWorks program. Okay, and so these constraints describe a very rich language for creating complicated mechanical systems. So this is just a sample system that I found online that was created in SolidWorks. I'm by no means a SolidWorks expert, but I know kind of the building blocks. Okay, so the way that these constraints are placed is basically you identify some primitive geometric elements, like a point, a line, a plane, a curve, things like that, and then you're going to put constraints between those geometric elements. So those constraints could be things like symmetry, angle, equality, distance constraints, which is what we've been focusing on in this workshop. But these other constraints, the angle, equality, symmetry, are things that our current rigidity models don't capture, okay? Okay, so just to give you some intuitions about these different types of constraints, I have an example, which I've got two rigid bodies here, as you guys can see. And let's see, so the first constraint I want to talk about is you can do an angle constraint. So you can have, let's say I want to identify this green plane on the front of this lovely pirate ship, and this green plane on the front of this little house, and I might want to say that those are parallel. So I can constrain those to be parallel. Let's say I fix this so that I get rid of the trivial motions. Well, that means that I can move my ship like this. I can move in all three directions, and I can still rotate. Okay, so I have 4 degrees of freedom left. I would have had 6 altogether. I've knocked out 2 with a parallel constraint. Okay, so maybe I want to start knocking out more degrees of freedom, and so I can actually say, well, not only do I want these to be parallel, I actually want them to be coincident. I want these two planes to be the same plane. And in that case, I've now knocked out 1 kind of translational degree of freedom. So I can only do this rotation and 2 translations. Okay, so now I'm down to 3 degrees of freedom. Well, maybe I want to get rid of this rotation. So I can identify this line coming out of the ship, the top of this house, the plane there. And I could say, well, I want that line to be perpendicular to the plane defined as the top of this house. Okay, so that means I can no longer do this rotation, and all I've got left are 2 kind of translational degrees of freedom. Okay, and so I can get rid of those with something that we're used to, point-point distance. Okay, so I have this bar. So now I get rid of 1. I still have 1 degree of freedom between the 2, but this last distance constraint, and if you're up to a little bit of construction, these 2 are now rigidly constrained. Okay, so there are different types of constraints that we're used to in rigidity theory. We're used to these point-point distance constraints, these bars, but these angle constraints are something that haven't really been studied. Does anyone have questions about kind of the types of constraints? It's also hard to picture them because they're angles. All right, so this is just a little movie of the same types of pieces in SolidWorks. I've put those same constraints between these 2, which means we know that they're rigidly constrained. But now I'm adding a constraint here, and what you saw was this little thing popped up and said, ah, you created an inconsistent system. And all of the mates, all of these constraints over here, you can't quite see them, but all the mates, all the constraints are listed over here. When you add an inconsistent constraint, the system says, that's not good, I can no longer solve this system, but it doesn't necessarily tell you a minimal set of constraints that you could get rid of to get back to something that was consistent. Okay, so again, I'm going to play this movie one more time so that what you see is I've got these constraints here. That's what's listed over here. Okay, I'm going to add a constraint that's going to be inconsistent. This little dialogue pops up. I suppress the constraint. I get rid of it. But notice that those two really were rigidly constrained. They moved together as a rigid body, as a rigid component. Yes. There should be the two distances. Is that what you're asking?
Y2
instead of 3? Okay. So if I do plane coincident, I now have 3 degrees of freedom, rotation, 2 translation. Yep. Yes, if it was parallel, then yes, I would have needed 3. Yeah.
When you say inconsistent, is it generically inconsistent or happens to be inconsistent to those numbers?
It's generically inconsistent. You could, I guess, find a consistent constraint for that position. And I'm not actually sure. I think in some situations, SolidWorks will say, oh, it's still consistent. But in some situations, it will actually say, even though it's consistent, you've over-constrained the system, and it will light up red. And it's not quite predictable what it's going to do. Because sometimes it will give you the correct minimal set of constraints and say, oh, here are the ones that you violated. It will find the circuit. But sometimes it will say, I don't know, just all of them light up red. And for the engineer, that's kind of the worst situation. You've got this huge constraint system. You put in your last constraint or one of your constraints, and everything lights up red. Okay, so clearly this is a problem for rigidity theory. Can we find the circuit? Then we can give better feedback to the CAD user and say, here's a minimal set of constraints. Throw any one of them out, and you'll be back to either under-constrained or well-constrained. Okay, so I probably don't need to go through these signs. The closest model that we know is, of course, body bar hinge. And we've got Tay's theorem, which is relating generic minimal rigidity to a count on an associated graph. Okay, and the count is the 6-6 sparsity, or 6 edge disjoint spanning trees. Right, and usually when you are kind of developing a new rigidity theory, you want to start with the algebraic concepts, define maybe a quadratic system of equations, look at the infinitesimal rigidity, try to find a combinatorial characterization because we're hoping that will lead to efficient algorithms. Okay, so that's kind of the path. And so now we're going to start with this new model of rigidity, which I'm calling body and cat. Okay, so I'm going to have rigid bodies, and I'm going to identify geometric elements on those rigid bodies, and I'm going to focus on lines, planes, and points. Okay, and then I'm going to look at pairwise constraints, which could be coincidence constraints. For example, I could have these two bodies, the cube and the tetrahedron, and I could have a line-line coincidence, right? So I'm saying those two bodies must share that line, right? Okay, I can also have angle constraints, which could be parallel, perpendicular, or just an arbitrary fixed angle. And again, for example, I could say, well, this plane on the red cube has to be parallel to this line that's attached to the tetrahedron. Okay, or I could have the plane line perpendicular, which is what you saw here, right, where I identify a line on one body and say it has to be perpendicular to a plane on the other body. So those are example angle constraints. And then the last one that I want to consider are distance constraints, which we can look at a distance between, let's say, a point and a plane, and we can say that that must stay a fixed distance. Okay, so because we've got the coincidence, angle, and distance constraints, I'm calling that CAD, which of course is also to indicate the motivation of computer-aided design. And if you kind of consider all the possible constraints, some of them don't make sense, so there's no angle constraints between pairs of points, you get a class of 21 constraints. Okay, so 21 coincidence, angle, and distance constraints between pairs of bodies, and you identify a line, plane, or point on each body. So what we did was we started with the infinitesimal rigidity. It's a little easier to just think directly in the infinitesimal world. Okay, in order to do that, This is exactly what you do for the body bar hinge setting. So you're going to use the Grossman-Cayley algebra, X tensors and tensors, Plucker coordinates, and the theory of screws and twists to kind of relate your constraints infinitesimally to what you're hoping to find as a rigidity matrix. Okay, and so with the body and CAD constraints, you have to do a little bit more work to get to the rigidity matrix. But this is the goal, is to have this rigidity matrix, and what you will see is that there's a pattern where the angular constraints have a different pattern than the rest of the constraints. Okay, but if I'm thinking 3D, I'm going to have six columns for each body and then rows to represent my infinitesimal constraints. Okay, so there's a couple things that we have to be careful of. When we think about these constraints, they may affect more than one degree of freedom. If you think about a hinge, right, that corresponds to kind of 5 degrees of freedom that it's blocking. Okay, and so that makes things a little challenging. If you think of the parallel constraint that I put in, right, it knocks out 2 degrees of freedom. Okay, and so what we want to do is introduce what I'm calling primitive constraints, which are only going to affect at most 1 degree of freedom. So for example, a line-line perpendicular constraint is a primitive constraint. It only affects 1 degree of freedom, and for us it means it will correspond to one row in the rigidity matrix. Okay. So I'm going to look at two different types of these primitive constraints. So if you think about when I was putting these constraints in, the angular constraints that I can add can only affect rotational degrees of freedom. Right? So between these two bodies, I have 6 degrees of freedom. 3 are rotational, the other 3 you can think of as translational. The angle constraints that I put in can only affect the rotational degrees of freedom. Whereas something like a bar, it's a little strange, it doesn't necessarily affect a rotational or a translational degree of freedom. So the angle constraints behave kind of specially, and we want to treat them explicitly. So again, I'm going to be looking at primitive angular constraints, which will only affect at most 1 angular degree of freedom, rotational.
Blind.
So blind is going to be the others. Yep, I hadn't said it. So I start with angular. So angular, everyone, hopefully that makes sense. Blind is a little less clear. It's just the other one. So a bar I would call a blind constraint, but I don't have a really good feeling as to how they behave other than they could affect rotational or they could affect translational. Okay, so the way that we create this rigidity matrix, we actually take for almost all of our 21 constraints, so point-point coincidence is kind of special, as you probably know from the double banana. I'm not going to, for that one it's special, but for the rest, the other 20, I can take my constraints and decompose them into 2 basic building blocks, I'm calling. So 1 primitive angular, 1 primitive blind. Okay? And so these are the 2. In the angular case, I have a line-line non-parallel constraint, which is going to correspond to a single row in the rigidity matrix. Okay? And the blind is a little more complicated. I'm going to consider a point P and a direction C. And this blind constraint is somehow going to express that the instantaneous velocity of that point is orthogonal, lies in the plane whose normal is C. Okay, so it's not clear why I need that, but my blind constraints are somehow going to reduce to this case. Okay, so again, I'm going to have some point P, a direction C, and this blind constraint, which you see here, the single row in the rigidity matrix, is constraining the instantaneous velocity of that point, subject to some twist or instantaneous screw, to be in the plane whose normal is C, to be orthogonal to C. Okay? All right, so actually what we did is we have 2 more kind of basic building blocks. So I start with these 2. These are each 1 row in the rigidity matrix. And then it turns out it'll be convenient to have another 2, which just these were kind of this non-parallel orthogonal. Now I'm going to look at line-line parallel and just use 2 of the orthogonal constraints, okay? And I'm going to again look at, well, instead of constraining my instantaneous velocity to be orthogonal, make it parallel to that vector. And again, that's going to be two of these constraints. Okay, so now I have four basic building blocks, but they're built up of these basic two. Okay, and so with those building blocks, I can now do something like line-line coincidence. I can express that with, well, I want my lines to stay parallel, so I can express it with the parallel constraint, the angular constraint of parallel, which is two rows of angular primitive constraints. And then I've got to say, well, I don't want my lines to be flying apart, okay, so I'm going to pick a point on my line and make sure that its velocity, its instantaneous velocity, stays in the direction of that line. Okay, and that's how I'm going to do a line-line coincidence. I constrain the lines to be parallel, and then so they don't fly apart, I pick a point on the line and I say its velocity has to stay parallel to that line. Therefore, it's staying on the line, and so the lines are infinitesimally staying together. Okay? And so again, now I'm using one of these and one of these. Okay? So I'm getting two angular rows and two of these blind rows.
Just in general orientation, are you dealing with specific points or variable points?
I'm assuming to start off.
Just the name of the point.
I'm assuming that someone's given me a framework.
Okay.
Yep.
And do these elementary constraints form a matroid, and is it generic or not?
Yes, they form a matroid.
Okay.
Is it generic?
Well, sorry, the algebraic version is a matroid.
Yes, yes. Because I'm making a rigid new matrix. Yep. And so then generosity is going to be defined in terms of that matrix. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions, I thought? No? All right, so one other example. Let's say we want to do a plane point coincidence. Well, we can say that we can express that by constraining that point to its velocity to lie in that plane. So again, just using one of those four building blocks to express this constraint. I'm not going to go through all 20 because you will fall asleep. Yes. Yes, I do point line coincidence, and it'll be point line should be this one because I want my point to kind of stay on my line. So it'll be two rows. Yep. Okay. So. If we go through and we have for each of those 20 constraints, and again the point-point coincidence is slightly different. That's going to be three rows, but it does not use those building blocks. Okay, so now we can build a rigidity matrix for these 21 body and CAD constraints, and for each one again we're getting these angular building blocks and these blind building blocks. And what's important is that means that we have some rows in our rigidity matrix which correspond to these primitive angular constraints, and then the rest of the rows are the blind constraints. And those primitive angular constraints have zeros in three of the columns, okay? Okay, so just to step back and look at the combinatorics, we're going to have, let's say, a CAD model. Well, we want to create something called a CAD graph. That's just expressing the constraints. And then from this CAD graph, we can create what's called the primitive CAD graph. Okay, so all I'm doing is I'm just saying, oh, well, for this constraint, I get two primitive angular constraints. Okay, so I just look at each of my constraints, and I figure out what primitive angular, which you see here in red, or blind in black constraints are going to be associated to each of those constraints. And now this is what I'm calling a primitive CAD graph that is corresponding to the rows in my rigidity matrix. Okay? Okay, so again, the recipe for rigidity theory, we did the infinitesimal theory, we have this nice rigidity matrix, and so now we want to look for combinatorial properties, and we're hoping to find a characterization. So there's this funny thing, right? I said these angular constraints have these zeros showing up. And somehow I want to capture those three sets of zeros. Okay? And so the natural counting condition that you would come up with is that kind of at the top level you need regular 6-6 sparsity, okay? Because you're dealing with 3D body based rigidity. But then for these angular constraints, they kind of nest inside and have to themselves be 3-3 sparse because you've got these zeros running around. Okay? So this would kind of be the natural Lamont type condition, Maxwell condition that you would think of. Okay, yes, and this is a matroid intersection, so we do have an algorithm. The algorithm is based on sparsity, which by now I'm pretty sure I don't need to talk about, and pebble games, so we do have an algorithm. But the problem is that while it is necessary, right, it's the exact counting conditions that you'd read out of the matrix, it's not sufficient. Okay, so this is my counterexample. Trust me that this is 6-6-3-3 nested sparse. This is it's three bodies and these are the constraints between them, but in fact this body slides back and forth. Okay, so I have an example that satisfies my condition but is not rigid. Okay, so now I have nested sparsity, necessary but not sufficient. So that sounds familiar to us because we're in joint in 3D. We've got 3-6 is necessary but not sufficient. Although even the 3-6 count is not well understood, so maybe I'm slightly better off because we do kind of have an understanding of this nested sparsity with the matroid intersection. Okay, so that left us with this question of, can we come up with a combinatorial characterization for this new type of rigidity? And is it as hard as 3D bar and joint? Probably not, but where does it lie between the well understood world of body and bar and the very not well understood world of 3D bar and joint? Okay, well, if I ignore point-point coincidences, which seem to be where the difficulties come, right, that's the double banana, then I do have a combinatorial characterization. Okay, so this is going to be the main theorem. I'm going to say a body and CAD framework that doesn't have point-point coincidences, generically minimally rigid, if, and now this is a little funny, so I look at my primitive CAD graph, I'm looking for, well, this says B prime, a set of black edges, a set of blind edges, such that B without those is three edges joint spanning trees, and red with those is three edges joint spanning trees. I know that doesn't make any sense, so I'm going to give you an example with a different set of counts. Okay, so instead of 3 and 3, let's look at 2 and 1. So here's a graph. I've got some red edges and some black edges. So I start with my graph having two colors. My edges are bicolored. Okay, and I'm looking for some set of black edges. Okay, in this case, I can choose just this one that I can add to my red edges, so that my red edges now form a tree, and the remaining edges form two trees. Okay, so it's stronger than my nested sparsity. My nested sparsity would have said, make the red ones form a tree at most, and then all together you've got to have six trees. But now I'm saying you want to partition the edges so that red are in one set, maybe there's some black thrown in. That set is going to form trees, and then the rest of it also has to form trees. Okay, so again, here's my graph. I'm looking at 2 and 1 instead of 3 and 3. Okay, so I want two trees for the black ones and one for the red. Okay, but I don't have enough red here, so what I'm looking for is, can I find some set of black edges, in this case just this one, that I can put with the red edges, so that now I have the correct trees on red. In this case, I'm just looking for one spanning tree, and my remaining edges are forming the other, in this case, two spanning trees. I see puzzled faces.
Point of view that if there are not enough red edges, that what easy can you do is contracting the red edges and look for a spanning tree in the rest,
Let me think. So it's kind of, yeah, so you can think of it as, if you think of the red as my angular constraints, I want to knock out all my rotational degrees of freedom. And I want to, I may not have enough angular ones to do that. So I'm going to take some of the blind constraints and throw them in. But I have to do that in such a way that the remaining blind constraints will knock out the other three translational degrees of freedom. So that's what I'm looking for. I know that this condition is hard to kind of parse. Shinichi, when I asked him about it, said, well, maybe think of it as you're making, So I get my graph, and instead I want two monochromatic black trees, and then the other tree can have red and black. So that, I think, made more sense to him. For some reason, this makes sense to me, and I think it's because I'm really imagining in my rigidity matrix, which I think I have, yes, in my rigidity matrix, I want to kind of say, okay, put my angular constraints together. Well, I know I'm going to need six trees total, but these guys can only affect maybe three of those trees. They can only participate in it in three of those trees. But they may not form three trees completely. So I'm going to need some set of my blind constraints to throw in with my other angular constraints, so that now I've got the three trees for my angle constraints, but I have to make sure that my other constraints still create three trees to kind of kill off those translational ones. Okay, so again, my condition is basically saying I've got this bicolored graph, I look at my red edges, there may not be enough to form the trees that I want. So does there exist some set of some subset of my black edges that I can throw in with my red so that now my red do create the trees that I want and the remaining black create the other trees that I want? Because I need six trees, but three of them somehow have to contain the red edges. Okay. Alright. So does anyone have questions that I can answer? Some people with me. I know it's early. Incident scan. Can you? Okay. You would like the proof, is what I'm hearing. Okay. Conveniently, I do have some slides about the proof. Okay, the proof is just a generalization of White and Whiteley's proof for Bonnie and Barr. Okay, and so we just generalize a lot of their concepts. So we start with a bicolored graph. We've got red and black edges. We're going to call it kg counted. So I'm generalizing the count number, the count parameters. Call it kg counted. I need to have kn minus k, 6n minus 6 total edges. And on the red edges, I have to have at most gn minus g, 3n minus 3, 3 sparsity on those. Okay, so that's my kg counted graph. And then I'm going to look for a kg frame, okay, which is going to be a graph together with an assignment on the edges, okay, to k tuples. But now I have this additional restriction that if my edges were red, the vectors that I assign to those edges have to have zeros in those first k minus g three columns. Okay, so this is my kg frame, and so this body in CAD is just a 6-3 frame. Okay, so I'm looking for basically my six trees, but then I need to say, well, three of them are going to have zeros. Okay, so this is actually the theorem that we're going to prove, which is that if I have a kg frame, it's going to be generically minimally rigid, and that's in terms of the rigidity matrix. Okay, if and only if there exists this subset of black edges where my B without those black edges is K minus G spanning trees, and my R with those edges is G spanning trees. Okay, so it's just generalizing all the concepts that were in Neil and Walter's paper. Okay, so again, we're going to have the pure condition, right? And we're saying, we'll call it C of G. The pure condition is just a polynomial in the indeterminate edge vectors. C that are the determinant of, and this is just the tie-down rigidity matrix for that graph, okay? We also need this kg fan. Okay, so a kg fan, here's the full definition, but basically I'm going to associate edges to each vertex, okay, and at most g of them should be red. All right, so again, I think the pictures will help. So I'm not doing the full count, but for the three total trees, one red, I'm going to have this be a 3-1 fan, 3-1 fan diagram, okay? So the diagram is encoding one distinct fan, even though you can have a lot of fans depicted by this distinct fan, okay? So again, for each of my, I'm going to tie down vertex one, and so for each of my other vertices, I'm associating three edges to it, which you're seeing because I'm orienting away from that vertex. So vertex four has got edge A, B, and F associated with it. And at most, one is red. Okay, so that is my kg fan. Again, I'm partitioning my edge set. I ignore vertex one because I want that to be my tie down. For all the other vertices, I'm associating k edges, and I'm saying at most g of them are red. Okay, and this is because it's going to express the pure condition in terms of these fans. Okay, so again, this is the formal definition. Here's an example one. Okay, so this is more. This represents more than one fan because I have ordered sets when I'm doing this. But I'm interested actually in just the distinct ones. And so this fan diagram represents a distinct fan. These are just different orderings on my edge sets. Okay, but it satisfies my condition. I have three associated with each vertex, three outgoing edges, and at most one is red. Okay, so then I can say that my pure condition is simply the sum over all of these distinct K fans, up to some sign of the determinants of these little matrices determined by those three edges. Okay, so again, I'm going to look at my, if I want to look at the determinant of my matrix, the pure condition, I'm looking at all of my K fans, all my distinct K fans, all my orderings that satisfy, directions that satisfy three, and at most one is red. And I can sum up, that means that my determinant is the sum of each of these fans, the factor of the little determinants based on those edge choices. Okay, so for each vertex, I'm associating k edges. Those k edges each have a little vector assigned to them. So now I've got a k by k determinant that I'm looking at. I have one of those for every single vertex except for the first one, and my pure condition is just the sum of terms made up of those. Okay? Okay, so again, so I have this proposition which is saying that my pure condition can be expressed as a sum over these K fans, these distinct K fans. Okay? The fact that I've got this red edge is helping at most one of those red edges, it's just making sure that I'm careful of the zeros that are popping up. And so now the proof sketch, and again, it's just a generalization of what's in White and Whiteley. For a direction, right, I want to say if I have a non-zero determinant, I should be able to find my tree decomposition. Okay? And so if I have my non-zero determinant, I do exactly what was in White and Whiteley. I think of it as grouping my columns by coordinate, but you're doing a Laplace expansion around each coordinate. Okay? And if you have a non-zero, then you know that there's some term sitting in there that's non-zero. And each of those little, and it's a product of these square determinants, which are n minus 1 by n minus 1, a tied down vertex. And they look like incidence matrices. And if it's non-zero, well, then I don't have a cycle. So I do have a tree, okay? And because of my zeros showing in my reds, I can only have my red edges showing up, let's say, in the last G columns. Because in the first K minus G columns, there's all these zeros running around, and therefore, they couldn't have been used in those trees. Okay, so again, my red edges, I do the same tree decomposition from White and Whiteley, but I know that my red edges could only have been in those last G trees because they had zero coordinates in all the others. They had zero values in all the others. Yes. It's the reds plus there might be some B prime. Yes. Those would have non-zeros, which is why you might have a choice of the B prime. But let me see if I can kind of draw this. So I think of it this way. I kind of tie down vertex 1, and now I'm looking at the remaining vertices, the remaining coordinates, and I'm going to look at, so these are my last G coordinates, K minus G, but think of these as the rotational degree of freedom coordinates, and I have my red edges somewhere, and so if maybe I've rearranged so that I've got my trees kind of showing up like that. Well, the red ones can't be used over here because they have zeros. There could be some black ones. So there could be some black ones that have some stuff over here. The red ones can only show up in here. But there could be black in there.
Yeah. And the black
is over here. But I just need one non-zero term so that I can one non-zero term in my pure condition so that I can pick out my trees. So if I have my one non-zero term and I've kind of done my Laplace expansion around the coordinates, I know that I'm getting little n my these are n minus one by n minus 1 determinants, and I know that my red edges could not have shown up here because they had zero values over here. So I know that they're over in the last kind of G pieces, but there could be some black ones that showed up. I might have had to use some black ones over here, may not have had enough red. And that's okay because those black ones will exactly form my B prime. Okay.
So you are not showing that you have a non-zero term in the sum that comes from that.
I'm saying that if I start with a non-zero pure condition, there must be some non-zero term that I can use to create my the forward direction. Forward direction.
Yeah, sorry.
Yep. So non-zero pure condition means I can pick out my trees. And I get kind of for free that my red edges only show up in those last trees and that some black edges may have shown up, and that gets me my B prime. Okay? Yep.
Equations themselves, the black and red equations, the rows, the entries, is it possible that, I forgot how the equations look like, is it possible that some of the variables used in black edges also occur in
Well, we're starting with a generic KG frame. So we're going to start off just thinking of them as just indeterminate. Okay. Okay. Yes, in the other direction, I'm going to pick something special. Okay, so... So forward direction is the easy part, though I don't think I'm explaining it that clearly. So forward direction, I have a non-zero determinant. That means I have some term that's non-zero. If I assume that I did my Laplace expansion around kind of the coordinates, then I'm getting K of these factors, and each factor is corresponding to one of these n minus 1 by n minus 1 square matrices, which has to look like an incidence matrix because that's the way the Rosemary Virginia matrix are formed, which means I have to have no cycle and I can pick out my trees. And then that's exactly what's in just Dwight and Whiteley, but now I kind of get for free that because I had those zeros knocking out some of the red rows, they couldn't have been in the first K minus G and they had to be in the last G. And yes, I may have had to use some of the black edges in order to pad the rest of those trees. Okay, so backwards direction, okay, I'm gonna pick an assignment, right? Backwards direction, I have my tree decomposition. Someone's handed me my K minus G and G trees, okay? And I want to show that I can have a non-zero determinant, which just means I have to find some edge assignment, right, that's gonna get me that non-zero. Okay, so this is the edge assignment that I'm going to choose. It's just basically, again, it's the same thing that's in the paper, except that I have to specialize my red edges. So all this is saying is each tree is going to get, every edge in a tree will get the same vector assignment. If I was in those last G trees, the rotational trees, well, I have to have these zeros. Okay. And that's going to mean that I only have one distinct KG fan contributing a non-zero term to my pure condition, and then I'm going to have that my pure condition is non-zero. So why do I have, which distinct fan is that? Same thing. I pick up all my trees, I root them at vertex 1, and then I think of directing all my edges along the paths that come to vertex 1. So I'm thinking of trying to orient my graph, because I know that an orientation of my graph that satisfies these counting conditions will be a distinct KG fan. So I pick it up, I hold it by root, by vertex 1 as my root, direct all my edges along the paths to the root, okay, and that's going to give me a non-zero term. But any other fan is going to have some vertex that now has two edges from the same tree. So any other fan that's not this one rooted with all the paths going to that root, any other tree has to have some vertex that has two, at least two edges from the same tree. Well, they'll have the same entries in their rows, and I'll get a zero determinant. Okay, so that means my only non-zero term is coming from this single distinct KG fan, which I got from my tree decomposition. Okay, so I think that's more than enough. I'm going to conclude. So again, we started with this new rigidity model, body and CAD, coincidence, angular distance, 21 pairwise constraints. We did the infinitesimal rigidity foundation, which is giving us this rigidity matrix. And then we looked at the kind of the natural counting combinatorial condition that you would think of, which is this nested sparsity. It's necessary, but not sufficient. Okay, and now we have this new combinatorial characterization for 20 of the 21 constraints based on a tree decomposition. Okay. So the things that are left, lots of things are left, but in particular, there's other constraints for CAD that this model doesn't deal with. And so it doesn't deal with symmetry constraints, doesn't deal with equality constraints, doesn't deal with multi-constraints. And then, of course, this is the one that I couldn't do, but I'm guessing that's pretty challenging because it's the double banana, okay? And so the infinitesimal rigidity theory is based on my dissertation work, and the combinatorial characterization of the tree decomposition is recent work with Jessica Simmons.